says qualify briefly. At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group. Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscience meeting. My name is Kim, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have met all those requirements. And I like more about alcoholism because it tells my story. I tried everything. I did not want to be an alcoholic. That was the last thing I wanted to be. The idea of being an alcoholic was just devastating to me. And I knew I was an alcoholic or long before I was willing to do the work. See, I had other ideas and other plans. You don't understand. I'm unique. I'm different. I can't do these steps. And all that uniqueness continued to kill me on the inside and almost killed me physically. And but I had to go to that place. I had to go to that place of desperation to be willing enough to come in here and get humble and ask for help. It took that total desperation, that total hopelessness to come here. And what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous is hope. I did the work and I had hope. For the first time, I had a whole week sober and I couldn't believe it. And by doing these steps, all of them, 1 through 12, with a sponsor, the obsession was relieved. And I could not believe it. I didn't fight that battle in my head on a daily basis. Am I going to drink? Am I not going to drink? Because I always drank when I sat there and thought about it. But the miracle happened in the inside. And not only that, I came here just to get sober. I just wanted it to stop. But what I got was so much more. My life is so full today, I cannot imagine that my life is where it is today. And I've been blessed so much just by coming in here, getting a sponsor, and doing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got freedom and a beautiful life. Thanks. The group has asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and refrain from moving around or talking while a person is sharing. And the speaker tonight is Keith, and I've known him for quite a while now. And I've had the opportunity to watch him walk through some stuff and apply these steps to his life. And he is truly an inspiration to me. And he not only comes in here, he does the work out there too. And he's helps people, and I'm glad he's a part of my life. Thanks, Keith.
I'm an alcoholic named Keith. And, great, whoa, nervous. Thanks, Brian. And grateful to be here tonight. You know, I came to a meeting, my anniversary was this week. I came to a meeting Tuesday and I saw on the board it said TBD on there. And I was like, what the hell is that?
Who's that?
I didn't know who that was. And then, you know, I've been asking Kim, yeah, let me help you. I want to do something for you, you know. And finally got a phone call. Hey, Keith, I need your help. So I called back, and here I am. So, thanks. But I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that when someone asks me to do something, I don't say no. So, of course, I said yes, and it's a pleasure for me to be up here. I was up here 3 years ago, and it was a rather, wasn't as short as Kathy when she was up here speaking, but it was pretty short because I was a little nervous. And I've got a little bit of time under my belt, but to speak in front of a group this large is a bit overwhelming. So, and I'm not going to picture y'all naked. it ain't going to work. I know, Ron, I know. But anyway,
give me 20 minutes to start.
So where to start? You know, my sobriety date, June 26, 1995. And what a day, you know. I was born outside of Philly. I don't know if you can tell if I still have my accent or not, but I grew up right outside of Philly. I had a great family. You know, I'm an adopted child. I have two adopted brothers, and You know, I also have two other, my father got remarried after my mom passed away, and I have two adopted sisters as well. So, you know, there's a lot of love was in my family when I was young. Most of that came from my mother. You know, there's another part of my story that I'm not really going to talk about, but I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and that's part of my story. I only mention it because I learned a lesson fairly early on in life. I struggled with it for a little while when I was a kid, and I finally told a parent what was going on, and no one believed me. So at an early age, to me, I learned that telling the truth didn't matter. So I lied a lot. A lot. You know, I lied about everything. And I remember one day in school, this kid was like karate dude. He had, I got my brown belt. I'm like, I got a blue belt. You know. Bring it in. It's a bathrobe, terry cloth bathrobe belt. But damn if I didn't bring it in and say, no, it's a karate belt. It's kind of shit. I would lie about everything. Did you see that show on TV last night? Yeah. No, I didn't see that damn show. But I lied. So I learned to lie early. Aside from that, you know, my mom died when I was about 12 and a half years old from cancer. And she was really the, you know, the pillar of our family. You know, she was the one who showed us love, who, you know, backhanded us when we did something bad. And my father was very unemotional, and he was a workaholic. You know, I don't think there were but maybe a handful of times where he actually, you know, told me he loved me when I was a kid. And so that to me, I didn't have a real lot of support after my mom passed away. You know, and so, you know, I kind of went crazy. You know, I did a lot of things that just kind of like living on the edge. Because to me, in my mind, you know, losing my mom, it's like, well, that sucks. You know, and life to me took a new meaning at a really early age. Like nothing really mattered. So that's how I pursued my life. It really, nothing mattered. You know, I didn't, responsibility, nothing mattered to me. And I learned that very early on. You know, I used to play the piano, and I started drinking at a fairly early age. I mean, pretty much right after my mom passed away. And I remember stealing my father's Canadian club and sitting there at the piano playing like I was some like Dean Martin dude, you know, just and drinking Canadian club and crying and, you know, just being a mess, you know. And I could do that because I was alone a lot. You know, my dad was not home. And my two brothers, you know, we weren't close, you know. And, I got to tell you, I was drinking alone almost from the very beginning, you know. And it really quelled a lot of that stuff that I had going on, all those emotions that I didn't know how to deal with, that I didn't know how to talk to anybody about. And I, to be honest, I wasn't really trustful of anybody. I didn't really want to talk to anybody about any of my stuff because, you know, I didn't think anybody cared, to be honest, you know. Aside from that, I mean, school, I never did any homework at school, ever. You know, I was a swimmer growing up. So I swam, you know, at 5:30 in the morning for a couple hours, and then after school I'd go to work out and swim for another 2.5-3 hours. And so I was, you know, that was really what my life was about. And swimmers back in the day when I was swimming, we partied a lot. So I started, you know, getting stoned on the way to work out when I was 13. And you know, I was a pretty good swimmer, it got to a point where that didn't even matter anymore. You know, that was the one thing I had going on in my life that I was kind of, you know, I was kind of proud of how well I had done. And but nothing mattered anymore. You know, it got to a point where I was in pain. My shoulders were beat up. I started getting cortisone injections in my shoulders when I was 14 years old from all the workout I was doing. You know, and I told, you know, again, I told my, it took my coach and my father like a year and a half to decide to let me go to the doctor, you know, because that was, then that's another message. Like, what, you know, I'm telling people stuff and they just don't care. So I just stopped telling people stuff, really, you know. The other thing, you know, I was a blackout drinker from almost the very beginning as well. I remember at 14 going to parties, like the seniors' parties and stuff, and just, you know, my dad was still single, you know, he didn't care. He was out flinging, dating, dancing, whatever he was doing. And, you know, he's, just as long as I could call and let him know where I was, then I could do whatever I wanted. And, you know, I'd black out. I'd wake up in the morning like, where the hell am I? You know, 14, 15 years old. And that was a natural, you know, I didn't really think much about it, to be honest. I wasn't like, oh shit, I blacked out. You know, I didn't care. You know, and, so that really was, you know, what I did. My dad got remarried to a woman that, oh my God, stepmother, you know, wicked stepmother. And, you know, how dare you come in my house and make these rules, you know. But she did. She was trying to put some, lay some groundwork, you know, like, you could need to come home. You know, because school's over Friday and then I'd see my dad on Sunday, and that's, she wasn't okay with that, but I resented her for that. Like, who the hell do you think you are, you know, a big 16-year-old tough guy, you know. And so there's a lot of animosity there, a lot of things happen, and it turned out that I wanted to go. I was at a meet and I saw one of my buddies at this meet, and he was at a boarding school, and I'm like, dude, what are you doing there? He's like, man, it's great. So I said, really? And I talked to the coach, and they offered me a scholarship, so I went to boarding school. That was my solution. Let me get away. But I was still where I, you know, I was still inside myself, so wherever I went, there I was. And the first year I was at boarding school was great. You know, they made you do homework there, so I actually had to do a little bit of homework. But I wasn't stupid by any means, which I thought I was, but I managed to get C's without doing anything. I thought that was pretty good. You know, and the coach at Princeton was talking to me about going to school at Princeton from ninth grade. I was like, that's cool. So, you know, I got into a little trouble my second year at boarding school. A drinking incident, and another was having a female in my room, and I didn't even fight it. You know, I just, the second time I was busted, I was like, I'm going home. And I called my dad, he came and got me. And then that last year and a half I was at home, it was like I ran away. You know, I did everything that you could possibly do just to, I don't know if I was craving the attention from my dad I wanted. I don't know what the hell was going on, but I was miserable. And I was just getting trashed. And I quit swimming after I left boarding school because it just didn't matter to me. And then I remember when I was a senior looking to go to schools, and my dad's like, you know, the school I wanted to go to was, you know, Syracuse, because Princeton told me no thanks after I left boarding school. But Syracuse, I went up and visited, and the coach, you know, the swim coach had talked to me a little bit. But my dad had told me that, you know, I'm not sending you to college. If you don't get a scholarship, then you're not going. So I had to start swimming again. And I'll never forget, I got into the Newhouse Communications School at Syracuse, and I was excited. I was really excited. It was, you know, a scholarship at a private school, still 20 grand that my dad had to pay. But the day I got my acceptance letter, he said, you're not going there. I'm not paying that. And that was when I made the grand decision that I was going to choose my college based upon the party that I had on my recruit trip, which is what I did. I went and visited about 10 different schools, and I partied at every single one, and the University of Pittsburgh was a winner. They were so lucky to have me that I was there. I got there on a Friday morning, and the next thing I knew it was Sunday, and I signed my letter of intent while I was there. So that's where I went. And but there I was kind of like running away from stuff again, you know. Excuse me. So I went to Pittsburgh, and my dad went to Carnegie Mellon. So in the back of his mind, I guess he was thinking, well, that's okay. Maybe you can transfer to Carnegie Mellon. You know, I'm like, are you serious? You know, my dad can do math on a slide rule. You know what I mean? I can't do math. So, but, you know, University of Pittsburgh was a disaster. I went there. I swam. I did really well. But injuries and drinking, because, you know, the nickel beer night, shit, I didn't know, you know, the keg, they had a great party under, it was, I partied, you know, that I don't think, my first year, I didn't go to any classes at all, except for to take my finals, my midterms and finals, that's the only classes I went to. I don't know how you know, back then you only needed like a 1.9 or something to stay in school and be eligible to swim, so, and I actually made it, and, but, you know, then I went home for the summer, and it was a disaster. Being at home was just, you know, I fought with my dad all the time, my stepmother. So I couldn't wait to go back to school. You know, the first year I went to Pittsburgh, they drove me out there. The second year, they dropped my ass off at a Greyhound bus station. My trunk said, see you later. So I think we were both of the same mindset, like, get the hell out of here, and God, I'm glad I'm gone. And but then, you know, after I injured myself, and it was the same injury with my shoulders, I started drinking a lot more. And there was a teammate on the team with me who drank just like I did and did everything else just like I did. And everything else, like, there are other substances that are part of my story. But I'm an alcoholic, and this is an AA meeting, and I'm going to talk to you about my alcoholism. And that's my primary. Anything else I was doing was just so I could drink more, to be honest with you. So, you know, I got to a point where I was, you know, I got kicked out of the dorms because I, you know, after I hurt myself, I lost my scholarship and I couldn't afford to pay anymore. And, I moved in with these, not great, they weren't the pillar of the community. You know, I moved in with these guys that like to party like me. And I found myself buying like red, white, and blue beer for $2.33 a case. Stuff is nasty, but I drank it, and I was happy when I found the change to buy the case, you know, and, you know, that's pretty sad, and it reminds me of, you know, in reading Bill's story, it's ominous warning, you know, I failed to heed, so many of those, I failed to heed, the blackout drinking, the, you know, living with guys normally would never live with, you know, buying not food, but using the last $2.33 I had to buy a case of beer. I was like, what, 20 years old, 19, 20 years old? And, but I didn't know I had a problem. You know, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just blamed everybody and everything around me for my problem. You know, I was the victim always, and you know. Then my story from here is really very cyclic in nature. It, you know, I would find a girlfriend, you know, and even though I was quite a catch, as you can imagine, most of the women that would want me as a boyfriend were not exactly all together. Because it had to be a woman who would put up with my drinking, you know, or one who drank just like me. So, for a long time, that's what happened. I was in these sick relationships, and knowing that this one would end, I would already have this one lined up. So that the packing of the bag and the moving could occur in the same night. You know, I always had a backup plan because, you know, I wouldn't want to put up with my crap, and I knew that at some point they were going to say, get the hell out of here. Because, of course, I would move into their apartment, right? They wouldn't move into mine because I didn't have one. But it got to the point, I was out in California. You know, I'd been bartending, and I was drunk. Of course, that's the job I gravitated towards. And but I went out to California to be an actor. You know, I was under this delusion that maybe I could make a living, you know, acting. Why not? You know. But that didn't go very well. You know, I had a bunch of auditions. I actually did a commercial, but nothing really happened. And I was living with this girl. And at the time, I wasn't drinking. You know, I moved to California with this girl and her mother, and we lived together in a townhouse. And I wasn't drinking. I was miserable. You know, I was absolutely miserable. And you know, the thoughts of like the insanity that was in my life, the thoughts that I had, the actions that I was taking. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't doing coming home, you know, late at night, you know, tripping over and waking up mom and doing all. But just the insanity of the thinking that I had. And it just got to a point where I was so depressed, I had to get out. And so I thought it would be a good idea to join the Navy. Get the hell out of there. Let me go join the Navy. That'll straighten me up. Right? So I did. I didn't tell her I was leaving. I didn't do anything. I just went and joined the damn Navy. So, and they sent my ass to San Diego, and I went to boot camp. And then I went to BEE school out in Great Lakes. And went to A school in San Diego. I was a sonar tech, submarines. And then I went out to sub school in good old Groton, Connecticut. And I had really not been drinking too much. Until I got to Groton. I was talking to somebody the other night, just last night, about this. You know, it was like penny beers for the enlisted at the E-Club. It was all the guys that were in my sub-school class were all a bunch of drunks, just like me. You know, we like to go out every single night. And the submariners' wives were like, their husbands would go out, and they would go right to the E-Club, and they were sick, man. They were trying to pick us all up. So I fit right in to that. I did. That was my, you know. But then something happened that it was the first time it happened. I went out, and I drank, and next thing I knew, I was in Pittsburgh. I came to in Pittsburgh. I had a blackout that lasted quite a while. I went AWOL from the service. And because Pittsburgh, I love Pittsburgh so much, I just naturally went back there. For whatever reason, I don't know, because I had burned a lot of bridges. And I had one friend there, and that's who I ended up staying with for a little while. But I was scared, you know, I was really scared. I ran away from the service, and I was so scared I didn't know what to do, so I drank. And, you know, I spent many, I was couch surfing in Pittsburgh and getting drunk every single day from the time I woke up to the time I passed out. And it was about 3.5 months when I finally got up the nerve one day not to pick the drink up and to go down to the Navy Yard, or I mean to the Navy office in Pittsburgh and turn myself in. And they were very happy to see me. We had a great reception when I got back up to Groton. They shipped me back up there on a train by myself. And you know, there was no shore patrol or anything with me. I went up there by myself and I turned myself in, and I said, well, I'll stay in the Navy if you want me to. And they didn't want me to. So after a court martial, I was let go. So, but I was lucky. I had an aunt in New York City who was an attorney, and she hired me an attorney. And I you know, I kind of got lucky, because I could have gotten a dishonorable discharge, and I didn't. You know. So anyway, and that aunt had a great idea. She said, why don't you come live with me in New York City? So I went to live with my aunt and uncle in New York City. And that place was crazy. It was crazy. I loved it. You know, I found a job as a bartender. I worked hard, you know, I gave my aunt and uncle some money. But then, you know, one night I went out and had a great time, and something happened. I started doing that all the time. You know, and I started stealing money from my uncle so I could go out and party like I was a millionaire. And needless to say, I ended up homeless in New York City after a few months. They kicked my ass out. I had nowhere to go. And It's funny, you know, my aunt and uncle were fairly wealthy, and they would take me to the polo shop and buy me clothes because I didn't have anything. And then so when they kicked my ass out, I was homeless. I was like on the streets of polo shit. And that was not a good thing, man. I mean, I'm telling you right now. You know, I'm laughing about it now because I can. But at the moment where I was there, it was the middle of winter. And maybe that's why I live in Florida now. But I was living in Central Park. I was sneaking into Grand Central Station. I was riding subways. And I used to walk with my head down around Grand Central Station because I didn't want to beg for money. You know, that's, we have these values. You know, I was a homeless dude with values. I didn't want to, like, you know, morally, I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to beg. That's, I can't go that low. I don't want to beg. So I'd walk around Grand Central Station with my head down, and I found enough money on a daily basis to buy a little food. You know, and I, of course, would buy some drinks. And I was just miserable, you know. And one night, the level of misery had gotten to a point where killing myself seemed like a really good idea. So I bought a bottle of vodka and a bottle of sleeping pills, and I ate the entire bottle of pills, and I drank the bottle of vodka. And this guy I had met when I was bartending, nice guy, his name was Kevin, I never forget him because he saved my life, just happened to bump into me when I was headed to Central Park. I was going to go lay down in the ditch and let it happen. And he bumped into me and realized that something was going on. And he took me back to his, he was an au pair, you know, a male au pair for this wealthy family. And he snuck me in the back door, took me up to his apartment, where I proceeded to vomit all night. And he cleaned me up all night, was washing all this. It was all night long. And I remember waking up in the morning and the humiliation that I felt, you know, that demoralization that I felt was overwhelming, and I snuck out and I left, and I never had a chance to say thank you to Kevin for saving my life, but he saved my life that night. And you know, I still didn't realize I had a problem. It talks about that in the Big Book, you know. There's something wrong, but I didn't realize I was an alcoholic. So I was still homeless, and I ended up hooked up with some people that I used to hang out with when I was drinking and had a place to live, and they let me stay with them for a couple of days because they saw I was down and out. Gave me a hot shower and let me steal their camera equipment so I could go to the pawn shop and sell it. And I bought a ticket to Philadelphia on the Amtrak train because that's where my family was. I thought, you know, I'll go home. They're going to want me home. And it's unfortunate that that wasn't the truth. When I got to Philadelphia, they wanted nothing to do with me. So I was still homeless, but now I was homeless in Philadelphia. And I was lucky enough to get into a homeless shelter in North Philadelphia. And I don't know if you've ever been to Philly, but North Philly, needless to say, I was like the only white guy there. And it was dangerous. And it was in the middle, if you know where Temple University is, right around there. And not a real great place to be. But they let me there. So I was in a shelter. And I don't know, I mean, it was insane. I got a job, you know, I wasn't drinking, but still I didn't realize I had a problem with alcohol. I wasn't able to drink. I was in a shelter, you couldn't come back drunk or they wouldn't let you in. So I didn't drink, and I got a job with Amtrak, working on a rail gang for a while, and things started going pretty well. I put a little bit of money in the bank, saved enough money to get an apartment, and then I bumped into my old high school girlfriend on the street, and I didn't tell her I was homeless. And I'd say, hey, I'm living in the shelter over there in North Philadelphia. But we started talking, you know, I guess even back when I was in high school, I've dated some sick girls because she wanted me to move in with her. So I did. And, you know, it was a sick relationship. She had just graduated from law school and was studying for the bar. And I was, you know, working for Amtrak. And once I moved in with her, I started drinking a little bit again, you know, on Friday when I get paid. So, of course, I wouldn't have any money by Sunday. But then she said something to me about not drinking anymore, and I said, oh, well, I'll give it a try. And I got to that point again where I was miserable and depressed, and it was winter time. And sitting in my car in the garage sounded like a really good idea. So I did, because I was miserable. And something happened. I was in there. I don't know what happened, but I decided that, you know, this wasn't the way to do it. So I went to the airport. I packed my bag, went to the airport, proceeded to get blitzed. And then I decided, I told the lady at the ticket counter I wanted a place. I want to go somewhere warm. So I went to Key West. Bought a one-way ticket to Key West. And lived in the little hotel there by the airport for 2 weeks until I ran out of money. And then I was homeless in Key West. And Key West was wonderful. I loved it. It was, you know, there are so many functioning alcoholics there that it's amazing to me. But I was in good company there. I felt, you know, I was there for a couple weeks. I was homeless, living in the Palmettos, and then someone, you know, said, "Hey, let me help you out," and they got me a job at the hell is it called, Billy's Bar and Restaurant down there in Key West. I was a waiter there, and it progressed. I never once thought, "Man, I have a problem with drinking," ever. But I ran away. That was my solution to a lot of problems, was running away. And, of course, the other cyclical issue that I had was to find women that I dated. And, of course, I found quite a few of them in Key West. And it's not to say that I there were parts of my life down there that were really good. You know, I loved Key West for a while. I did really well down there. I was responsible for a little while. I felt better about myself. But every time I stopped drinking, I'd start feeling like shit again. So, and it got to a point where I was doing a lot of something else down there, you know, and I just lost everything. I was drinking and lost my girlfriend, lost, you know, house, lost everything, lost job. And after about 8.5-9 years, I was homeless in Key West again, living on the beach. And this time no one came by and said, "Hey, you know, let me give you a job." And it got to the point where walking in front of a bus looked like a good idea. So I set out one morning when I got up to walk out in front of a bus. And I lived on Key West for a while, and I've been all over the island. And one day I was walking and went to a street I didn't ever go down before, and I ran into the mental health clinic of the Lower Keys. And someone took me in there, and I think that was my higher power. And the second I went in there, the lady at the desk was like, can I help you? And I started crying. And I said, I want to kill myself. And they Baker acted my ass so quick. It's not funny. And this old couple put me in the back of a station wagon, like one of those old like 70s station wagons. But it had like chicken wire between the driver's seat and the back, because I was crazy. And that's the beginning of what turned out to be, you know, the beginning of my life. You know, I was in, they took me up to Marathon, the mental health clinic, the Middle Keys, and I was in the CSU unit with all the other crazy guys and girls. And I'd been there a couple days. I got into sleep. I hadn't slept in a while, you know, like a full night's sleep. I couldn't really talk or read very well. I was a mess. And there was this guy who worked at the place who, his name is Brian, and I'll never forget him. He came over to the CSU unit because he had heard my background a little bit. He worked there, and he said, I think you need to come over to this meeting that we're having over here. And he took me across the hallway to the detox unit, and I sat in this AA meeting. Now, I had been down. There's a place in Key West called the Anchors Away Club. Now, I had been by the Anchors Away Club before and had had some coffee from the Anchors Away Club for free. But I had never gone into a meeting. You know, I would go there and hang out with other guys like me that didn't want to go in the meeting, just wanted to sit outside and drink coffee. So that's what I got out of that. But here this guy got in there as a speaker meeting, and this guy Brian was telling his story. And one of the first things he said that never has left my mind is, you never have to feel that way again. He didn't say what that feeling was, but I knew exactly what the hell he was talking about. You never have to feel that way again. And he told his story, and his story was my story. And a light bulb flickered on in my head. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. For the first time in my life, I realized that there was something wrong. Like, there was something wrong. And there, I knew what it was. I was an alcoholic. And it's amazing. This guy, Brian, I saw directly the result of his work in his steps, because he was all 12-step on me. I can tell you that. Not only did he drag me to a meeting, but then he sat down afterwards and talked to me. And he asked me if I wanted to go to a treatment center. And I said, yeah. Why not? And he got permission. I stayed in the CS unit for 6.5 weeks until a bed opened up at the Village South in Miami. And, you know, my sobriety date is June 26, 1995. I got sober before that date. But my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was at the Matchbox in Marathon on that date. So that's my sobriety date. Because I'll never forget that meeting. I'll never forget going up and grabbing my white chip. It was one of the hardest things I had to do. But I knew I had to do it. And, you know, I can go on and on about, you know, treatment. I was in treatment 6.5 months. I was in a 3/4-way house 1.5 years after I got out of treatment. Because I needed it. My sponsor said, yeah, I got a sponsor pretty quick. And I had my treatment sponsor. You know, I did my treatment 4-step. But it was relatively inadequate when I got out of treatment. And I got a new sponsor, and I worked my steps with my sponsor through the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. But 1.5 years you know, the first 2 years of my sobriety was amazing. I lived with a bunch of guys just like me who were struggling to stay sober, working. I decided to go back to school. You know, I had a great sponsor. I had the best sponsor in the world. He told me exactly what I needed to hear when I needed to hear it. And he gave me jobs. You know, my first service work was going to a meeting, and they gave me a little glove, and they had me pick up the cigarette butts outside. That was my first piece of service work in AA, picking up somebody else's nasty cigarette butts. But I did it. Then they gave me a key to this meeting and said, you need to set up and make the coffee. And I did that. Did that for 1 year. I did whatever they told me to be honest with you. Because this book says we are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I can tell you that when I got in, I was hopeless and I was desperate. You know, I had thought about killing myself 3 times. I tried it once, but was real close to trying it the other 2 times. That's where staying dry without doing anything gets me. Because I'm sick. So much has happened since I got sober. You know, it wasn't difficult for me to do the step work. You know, I did everything. My sponsor said, stay away from women your first year in sobriety. And, you know, I'm sure that the women's sponsors say, stay away from the men. Because we sick. You know, like, what is one sick person going to do with another sick person? It isn't one whole person. It's two sick people. I had nothing to offer anybody. So I stayed away from women for the first 2 years I was in recovery. And that was the best thing I ever did. Because I got to know who I was and what I wanted. And I went back to school. I always used to lie about my degrees. You know, the bar, you know, yeah, I got my master's. You know, I hadn't even graduated from college. So I went back and I graduated from college. And then I went back and I got another degree. That was my JD, which I don't use. So, but it was fun. You know, I love education. But it gave me a sense of self and belonging that, you know, when I got here, I couldn't speak or write or talk or read. I couldn't do anything. And going back to school really gave me a little bit of confidence to let me realize that I wasn't as stupid as I always thought I was. I hadn't talked to my family in 10 years. And one of those things, I made a list. My sponsor made me make a list of those things that I really wanted in life. What do you want to get in sobriety? What is it that you want? And I wanted to have a relationship with my family. And my dad, and God love him, it took him 5 years to invite me to their house for Christmas to be in sober. 5 years. But I earned every bit of that 5 years for what I had done to that family. But now my dad and I talk on the phone every single day. Every day. And my dad, who didn't say he loved me when I was a kid, says he loves me every time he talks to me on the phone. And, you know, it's amazing. You know, if you're new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, don't cheat yourself. You know, even if a drink is looking good to you, don't cheat yourself. Remember where you came from. You know, I remember every single morning when I wake up where I came from. That hell, I do not want to go back there. And I was also told that as I'm sober, I have a choice whether I want to be happy or I want to be miserable. It's a decision I can make on a daily basis with what I do with myself. You know, life happens. People pass away. I've lost my grandparents, all of my grandparents since I've been sober, my cousin Kenny. And great pain. I was close, very, very close to my grandparents. After my mom died, my grandparents essentially gave me any, you know, type of love that I got from them. And I got to hold their hands when they died, you know, and be there. And, you know, friends. I have some of the best friends I've ever could have thought about. And, you know, I learned how to have relationships with people in this program. It took me a long time, but I also, you know, I don't have any kids. I've never been married, but I finally found a woman that I want to spend the rest of my life with. You know? And it's a healthy relationship. We actually talk about the big book and step work at home. You know? And it's natural. I sponsor guys today. You know, life has not been the easiest thing in the world. There's stuff has happened. I've gone through a lot of stuff in sobriety. But I stay sober. And because I get up in the morning, I do the things I need to do. And, you know, this, I had marked the big book because, you know, all the great stuff I know is right out of this book. So it got me sober. But I knew that I wasn't going to, I brought my reading glasses. It's like I was going to try to read something. Last time I tried that, I got lost. I was like, there's so much good shit in here. I don't know what to read, you know. But then I realized I don't have to read it, you know. But I hope you do. The first 164 pages of the big book is amazing. I read this book and I see myself in almost every single page of it. And I am so grateful to be here today, to be sober and to have had the chance to tell part of my story. I know I rambled a little bit, but you guys have been very nice. And thank you.